Welcome to Beyond the Boundaries, a group relations podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ellen Short, and this is season two of the podcast, and the title and the theme of season two is Capturing the Legacy and Future of Group Relations. And for this episode, our guest is Mac Wemuck. I'm going to read his bio and give you an introduction of him. Mac Wemuck, whose pronouns are he and him, operates his own business under the name of Luna Consulting and Coaching. He consults in the areas of health equity, racial equity, and social justice, and he coaches and develops nonprofit executives. He is a co-creator of Group Relations International, also known as GRI. He's the vice president of the Washington Baltimore Center for the Study of Group Relations. He's a member of the Group Relations Centers in Boston and Chicago, and he has various roles in ACRI, including serving as a director, development mentor, and as a member of the Reparations Committee and the Conference Committee. Mac Wemuck began his group relations journey in 1993, and he has staffed over 60 conferences, very impressive, and he has directed 8 group relations conferences. He is the current weekend conference director for the Boston Center, and Mac Wemuck is the father of 4 powerful young women and is based in the Chicago area. So Mac Wemuck, I want to welcome you to the GRI Beyond the Boundaries podcast, and it's a pleasure to have you as a guest.
Thanks so much, Ellen. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And I want to start, as I have started with all of the guests that we've had so far, just to remind our listeners that we know each other professionally. And I wanted to just speak a little bit about my experience of knowing you in group work. And I know I've told you this so many times, you're probably so tired of hearing it, but one of the best things about knowing you is that you were my first small group consultant at my first group relations conference. And I just want to say, so our listeners understand the significance of that, is that I think for those of us who do this work, often the first conference that we go to and the first consultants that we interact with, I guess I would say, imprint on us, right? Because those are very powerful, usually powerful experiences. And mine was at Northwestern University. I was a master's student, as you know, in Dr. Sonny Citrenbaum's course. And, you know, I had a year with a theory with Sonny, and one semester was devoted to group relations, and we were required to attend a conference. And so I did. And that's how I met you in terms of your small group consultancy. The last thing I will say about that is that one of the things that imprinted on me was what happened in the group, which I will not go into, but also the way that you were so clear in your consultant's role about telling us repeatedly about what was happening. It was very, you know, it really made an impression on me, the clarity with which you were observing us and repeatedly telling us, and that we were repeatedly ignoring you and also hearing you and heeding what you were saying, ignoring you. And then, you know, there was a rhythm to it, but also that you spoke to us as a group. And that was the first time I had really like had that kind of group experience with such clarity. So I wanted to also say that to you. And then we've had other experiences at group relations events, committees, and I also attended a conference, I think in 2021, that you directed, which was a really great experience online. That was my first virtual conference. And so, you know, I just wanted to say that those have been my experiences of you and with you. And they've been, I've learned something each time that I've worked with you.
I appreciate that, Ellen. And for me, one of the best parts of that is that we have become friends. You know, I'm fortunate enough to count you as one of my friends.
Yes, I feel the same. And thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. So having said all of that, I want to go into our questions. And as I have asked most of all of our guests, actually, we have a few questions. And, you know, I want to ask you to just be as open and as comfortable as you possibly can with your responses. I know they will be interesting. And the first question that I have is how you were introduced to group relations work and what you learned about it and what attracted you to the work initially.
In late 1992, early 1993, I was a member of the management staff of an organization called the Latino Institute. It no longer exists. It existed in Chicago for a long time and was quite prominent in for its work for the Latino community, doing a variety of things. My work was advocacy and spilling over a little bit into management development. We were, as is typical for many not-for-profits, we were a group of experts in our fields, and yet, quite frankly, we didn't know much about management per se. So among the things that we did, we brought in a consultant, and the consultant happened to be Vanji Holvino, who's one of the luminaries in this work. And Vanji was very frank with us after she assessed. She basically said, you all know squat about management and have a lot to learn. And she also recommended as one of her interventions that we attend a group relations conference. I was very eager beaver in those days, so I put myself forward to be the guinea pig. And I went to my first conference in the spring of 1993 at Howard University. It was the WBC, what was called at that time the WBC Diversity Conference. And it was directed by the great Leroy Wells. It was my only experience of him as a director. And it went over my head, quite frankly. I had been trained up to that point in the NTL, the National Training Laboratory's T-group model, which is the focus is very individual. So I remember sitting there in my first conference as a member, asking my fellow members, why are you making such a big deal about this staff? I mean, what's the big deal? You know, let's ignore them. And the real action is here between us, amongst us, you know, because that's the T-group model. So that one went over my head. I went home and I reported, I went back to the Latino Institute. I reported on my learnings. We all sort of scratched our heads a bit because we still weren't figuring out why Vanji had recommended the experience. But luckily enough, even though it was still shrouded in mystery for me, there was a conference happening later that year in Chicago. And that was a conference directed by Bob Lipgar at the University of Chicago, based at the University of Chicago. And I thought, this is a great opportunity for me to experiment with this method again. You know, I'm still not sure what it's about, but I'll go. It's right here in my home city, and it's convenient. And the organization, the institute sponsored me. And that's when I began to get it. One of my routes to beginning to understand the work was being used by the membership, being put forth as an alternate conference director. You know, I knew squat about directing, but I was put forth as an alternate conference leader as in direct competition with Bob Lipgar. And it was the beginning of my learnings about how one would be employed by a group. So I began to get it. All of a sudden, the light bulbs turned on in terms of the unconscious, in terms of group as a whole, in terms of valences, etc. And that was deepened a few months later. I took advantage of another Chicago area opportunity. I went to Sonny Sitrenbaum's Northwestern-based conference, which you've referred to. And I began to get it further. Again, the unconscious, the group as a whole, the ways that people are being employed by groups, valences, et cetera, all that began to dawn on me, right? And it went from there. I went to the national conference in 1994 as a member. I was in a small group with Sarah Bursitis and Lori Nisko, both of whom are very active in the group work right now. I went again as a member in 1995 because in those days, in order to punch our ticket and become certified to consult, the requirement was 10 days of residential experience as a member. And so you could do it in a variety of ways. And one route would have been to put together a national conference, which in those days was 7 days long, and a residential conference. And there were two going on in the United States in those days. One was a WBC's 5-day residential at Bryn Mawr. And another was the Boston 5-day residential held in various places. But rather than do that, I decided, oh, heck, if I'm going to do a national and a 5-day residential, I might as well just do two nationals back to back.
So very interesting, the progression that you had from the first one being recommended by Vanji. And you're absolutely right. She is one of our luminaries in the work. I miss her in the work as well, miss her presence. And then you didn't get it, but I think it's really interesting that you didn't get it, but there was something that happened at that first conference that made you curious enough to go to the next one. And, you know, the next one was directed by Dr. Leroy Wells. And I want to ask you about that one particularly, because I want to ask you if you can say a little bit more about what it felt like for you to be used. Oh, that was the Bob Lipgar conference, right? Okay, the first one was Dr. Wells, and the second one was the Bob Lipgar conference. That's correct, right? Where you felt like you were being used to compete with the director, right? Which was Bob. Can you say a little bit more about how that felt for you and what that process was like?
I'm going to combine two conferences. One, that Chicago conference, and the other being Sunny Citrobon's conference in January of the following year, because I took up similar roles in both. I was used in similar ways in both conferences.
Okay.
You know, I also was very prominent in Sunny's conference and to a certain extent was put forth as a competitor to him by the membership. So, you know, I think it's not spoken too often in our work, and I haven't tracked it lately. But back in those days, I was very aware of one of the key motivators for entering the work, and that is that it was quite ego gratifying to be recognized as a leader, and it was quite ego gratifying to be recognized as good at the work, quote unquote. That was definitely a slice of my experience that kept me, that made me want to learn more, both as a member and eventually as a staff member. So that, the ego piece, which is very human, very natural, but at least in those days, we often didn't talk about it as being one of our motivators for getting into the work. Yes, of course, I became fascinated by all of these things, by all of these lenses, the unconscious group as a whole, valences, etc. But there was a healthy slice of ego as one of my prime motivators for entering the work.
I get that. And I appreciate you elaborating on it. And I agree with you that I started the work after you a bit, but I don't remember a lot of conversation either about the ego gratification that you're speaking about. I asked you also because I've also had the experience of being used, as many of us have, and also in leadership role. And it's been sometimes really difficult for me to realize that I was being used. But then I think as the years have gone by and my experience has deepened, I have an appreciation of, it's almost like I know I'm being used, but it's for the work and it's also for me for whatever reason. And I can reflect on it later, but in the moment I'm just rolling with it. So I appreciate your you're talking a little bit more about that. And I'm also thinking about another piece of what you're talking about too, which is, don't you think it's interesting when you get used for leadership roles, because it says something about obviously the group's attitude about the actual designated formal leader, right?
It does.
So for me, when let's say I was consulting to a small group and the members informally authorized a male, sometimes maybe a white male or a male of color, it would immediately tell me that there was some anxiety about being consulted to by an African-American woman, you know, who would be me in that case. And I would use it in my consultations, but it was also fascinating to me how the group shows you how they feel about the leadership role. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. It's been consistent in my observation throughout my group relations career. And I have a very recent example, the Boston Center Comp Weekend Conference that I directed about a month ago. The membership put forth as my representative among the membership a young Latine man, right? And he was quite verbal. You know, I think a lot of people thought he was quite annoying at times. He had good things to say, but he was mobilized a lot, right? So following along with your thought, which is a fascinating one, you know, these days, I am both indigenous and Latine, but these days I am leading with my indigenous identity. And I think one of the messages that the membership might have been broadcasting at that point is, we're not really used to this indigenous identity stuff. You know, we prefer a leader that's much more that is leading with his Latine identity rather than an indigenous identity, because we don't quite know what to do with the indigenous identity. So,
yeah, that's really interesting. And I really like how you process that and how it showed up in the conference universe that you were in as a director. And I think it's fascinating. I think it's really interesting. And it consistently happens. And now it's happening to you, I think, you know, with you focusing on both of your identities and with you putting forth your, as you say, your indigenous identity more prominently, it's probably deepened that experience for you.
I think it has. But from the member perspective, of course, you know, one of the things that we know happens all the time, members struggle with the notion, especially when they're new in the work, they struggle with the notion that their individual actions in groups are not solely up to them. It's really scary for them to face the notion of group as a whole and unconscious group as a whole process, to think that the group as a whole, consciously and unconsciously, is exerting that much influence on what they do and say in a group. Is a very scary notion for them, because it goes counter to, especially here in the United States and the Western world, our notions of individualism and control.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, McLamuck, on that, because that was my first experience of just not having the control, but being fascinated by the fact that I didn't have it, thought I had it, was afraid of it. You know, and I've seen it repeatedly with members throughout the years. And I've also seen it with my students who also come into, you know, when I was teaching group work for many years, come into the class focusing on their individuality and really being quite dismissive of group dynamics and groups in general until they really see how powerful the group really is. It's a really interesting process. So I appreciate your responses and also being able to reflect on that with you. So then I want to go to the next question, which is, I want to ask you if you can identify some significant mentors in group relations or colleagues, if you don't describe them as mentors, and what you learned from them. Could you share that?
Absolutely. With a great spirit of a debt of gratitude to all these folks. You know, being a BIPOC individual, I'll start with the folks who are BIPOC, because they were really, really significant to me. Joe Wright was one, Lamise Girard, Linda Powell, Earl Braxton, a woman by the name of Janice Ruffin, who was out of the New York area and who worked in the Chicago Center of Conferences a lot. Richard Childs, the Reverend Dr. Richard Childs, a wonderful practitioner. These figures, these mentors of color, these teachers of color taught me a lot. Very powerful individual experiences with them and learned a lot about the work. As far as white people are concerned, three that I would name right off the bat are Sonny Sitrenbaum, for whom I worked a lot over the course of the years. I probably staffed 12 of Sonny's conferences.
Wow.
Yeah. Carla Hayden, one of my very early teachers, very important. And Renee Mollenkamp. And even though Renee started the work just a year before I did, I've always considered him a mentor of mine and a teacher of mine. So those were three very prominent figures. In terms of colleagues, of course, Kimberly Turner, who passed away earlier this year, a great, great loss to me. Kimberly had been my associate director in the last four conferences that I directed before this last Boston conference. So we had a dear, dear friend and a longtime friend and colleague. So quite a loss. Candace Crawford Zakin, all right, is someone who we've learned from each other over the years. Danny Kennedy, a good friend and a good colleague, and a gentleman by the name of Jeff Reed. So I don't know if many people remember Jeff Reed, but Jeff Reed practicing out of the New York Center and no longer that active in group relations work, or at least not to my knowledge, but a wonderful practitioner. And I consider him, I miss Jeff. I miss the opportunity to work with Jeff these days. So those are some of the significant people.
Thank you for the list. That's quite a list of significant people. And I wrote down some names that you had mentioned. First of all, I do want to say to you, with regard to Kimberly and your loss and our loss, that, you know, I give you my condolences. I was not aware that you all had a close relationship in that way. And so I know that must, as you say, have been a great loss for you. And I remember Jeffrey Reed. I remember Jeffrey Reed from the NYU conferences that he came and he did. And he was, and also some at TC, because I was really young in the work then. And I remember him inviting me to one of his TC conferences. He was a very interesting consultant and director. So very charismatic. And I miss him in the work as well. So. I know some colleagues who have, you know, worked with him at conferences, but not in the last, I would say, 15 years have I heard anybody mention his name.
That's
so
right.
That was really nice. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Great too. Yeah.
Nice to hear. And I remember Janice Ruffin too, because she was on staff at Sonny's conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And I also remember Richard Childs. Also this for the same reason.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Wright, I had an experience of him. It was very interesting. I had no idea who Joe Wright was and how significant he was in the work, but I attended Deborah Neumayer's whiteness conference in the late 90s at TC. And Joe Wright was a member of that conference, not the staff. He was a member. And he was in my small group. I really should say that I was in his small group, but he was in my small group. And I, again, had absolutely no idea who he was, but he had, he was very challenging of the staff in the conference opening. And I had no idea about why that was happening, but I later understood what was going on. But I just want to say that's my only experience with Joe. And I think it was good that I didn't know his significance in the work, because we connected as members and he was so supportive of me. I was doing my thing, which I used to do back in the day, of challenging. It was a whiteness conference. So I was challenging white people, you know, talk about whiteness. I want to hear you talk about whiteness and let's do that work together. Right. And I'll talk about my identity. And Joe was very, very. He was very much doing his own thing, but he was very supportive of me in that way. And later on, when I realized how significant he was in the work, I considered that to be a gift, actually, to have had that experience with him.
Yeah, well, he certainly was significant to me. I had a enormous reparative experience with Joe in terms of my relationship with my own father. I won't go into the details there, but let me say that with Joe, I experienced a father figure who was actually interested in the things that I was interested in. We were passionate about the same things, and that was not an experience that I had with my own father. And that was an enormous reparative experience for me that really was impactful. Also, as a director, you know, from Joe, I learned the principle of don't sweat the small stuff. Joe never sweat the small stuff. He put the emphasis on the core of the work and what was really important and not worrying too much about the smaller details, right? So
that's really valuable. That's really valuable learning that you got from him. And then the last thing I wanted to say was about Sonny and our mutual experiences of Sonny and just his significance in the work and as a director of many years for the Northwestern Conference and as a professor and just all the different roles that he played in people's lives in group relations work and outside of group relations work. And he, I consider to be, I really appreciate you saying that about Joe Wright in terms of the paternal experience, because I consider Sonny to be my father in group relations work. And I was having, at the time that I met Sonny, I had a very good relationship with my father, but he was very ill at the time that I got into the master's program. And, you know, he had dementia. And so he was losing himself. And I was watching it, and it was heartbreaking. And his name, my dad's name, nickname was Sonny. So, you know, it was very interesting, this immediate paternal bond that I felt towards this man, Sonny Citrenbaum, that I had. I didn't even know him that well. But as I got into the group work and he mentored me a bit before I you know, left for New York, that was just a really wonderful foundational experience. And so I think this is interesting that we both connect with significant figures in the work around fathering, right?
Indeed. Yeah, I could lay claim to Sonny as one of my fathers in the work too, definitely.
I thought so. I thought he was, yeah.
Having worked with him so much, and what Sonny, one of the things that Sonny taught me is bark with grace. He so gracefully adhered to, enacted bark. You know, he was faithful to the principles with a lot of grace. He was very significant in the life of a lot of us. And when what turned out to be a temporary but lengthy retirement from the work in 2006, my departure was at the last conference that I staffed for Sonny in January, February of 2006. And it was not easy for me to leave him. Not at all. It was quite a choppy ending because there was so much loaded into it. So,
yeah, that's very meaningful. I would say one more thing about that. I did not know, before I move on to the next question, I did not know that that was when you departed, but I do want to talk about that because I'm moving into a question about what group relations work means to you now. But before I do, I want to say I left him too.
Yeah.
And I it was leaving him. And it was leaving the conference work because by that time I was really doing a lot of work in New York with Mary McCrae. And what I was experiencing was working with people of color in New York in a way that I wasn't able to work with people of color and race and culture at Northwestern. And I was angry a little bit about that not happening in the same way at Northwestern, not at any person, but just the experience was... It made me sad, actually, not to be able to do more work around that. And so I decided not to do the Northwestern conferences for a while because of that. And I actually let them know, you know, Vicky and Sonny, why I was not returning. And I needed to do it. It was something I needed to do. They were very accepting of that. And I came back. He, you know, we saw each other at one of the dialogues and I went to his presentation and we saw each other afterwards. And you know, he said something like, "Are you ready to come back?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And it was really lovely. It was a lovely moment. But again, you know, I think you and I have had this parallel experience of leaving, and it's hard to do. It was really hard for me to do that. But I needed to do it, and I learned a lot from it. So I share that with you because of
for
that.
Me, I sometimes put it in terms of, it was a necessary part of my developmental process, a necessary part of my creation process. Right? So.
That's exactly what I think it was for you. I think I like the way you put that. And I think that's the way it was for me. And actually, Sunny even said something like, you needed to do it. And it was good that you did. So I agree with you on that. And I want to segue from that into asking you about what group relations work means to you now, personally and professionally. And I'd like to connect it to your hiatus from the work and your return. And could you share with us some thoughts about that?
Well, let me start with the hiatus, and I think that will lead us into it, and I'll depend upon you to guide me here. But, you know, I was very clear from early on in the work about my ambition in the work. And I think, again, in those days, ambition wasn't spoken to very explicitly. Folks had lots of ambition, which I think is a very human and natural thing. But very few people were laying claim to it explicitly. I was different than that. I laid claim to my ambition quite clearly. I wanted to be as good as I could be in the work, and I eventually wanted to direct. So by 2006, when I departed the work, I had become recognized as a very good practitioner, and I had directed a number of times. And had by that time been face to face with the reality of the disparity between the vision of directorship as sort of a golden ring and the reality of directorship as just being a load of very tough work, right? that a person has to approach with a servant attitude, with a servant leadership attitude in order to be able to endure, quite frankly. We can say more about that later. But it was clear to me that by 2006, I had satisfied the ambitions with which I had started out. And I was tired. I, having been recognized in the work in a variety of ways, you know, it had taken over much of my free time, much of the time that I spent not making a living. I was doing group relations things. And I wanted that time back. So I decided I'm going to step back from this work. And I was gone essentially for 13 years. I did do some work because part of my departure was to let my membership in ACRI lapse. And even though I was a certified consultant, without membership, you didn't really have the right to work. So, but colleagues and friends hired me in that 13-year period for conferences that weren't ACRI-sponsored conferences or ACRI-endorsed conferences. So I probably did half a dozen conferences in that time just to keep my hand in. But I essentially considered myself to be gone and really didn't have really bright, clear plans to return. But in 2019, you know, I took note of the fact that Sunny had retired from the Northwestern Conference system as director and that Vicky Seglin was directing. And I wanted to experience a conference led by my old friend and colleague, Vicky Seglin. So I came back as a member in January of 2019 and got excited again about the work, right? I started as soon as people knew that I was back, they started offering me staffing opportunities. So I started staffing again and got more and more excited about the work, and then was offered the opportunity to direct the conferences in 21 and 22 for WBC and forward from there. But the break was really about wanting to do other things, having fulfilled my initial set of ambitions, wanting to do other things, wanting parts of my life back. And yet then coming back in 2019 and realizing how much I loved the work, right? But coming in this time, pretty early on when I returned, I came in with the notion of, okay, if I'm going to do this, my purpose became clear fairly quickly. And that is, you know, I came back to experiment. And the experiment, I've said it a variety of ways at different times, but it's essentially, is this work useful enough to the cause of social justice, particularly racial justice? And we know we have a very powerful learning method here. It's not the be-all, end-all, but it focuses on things that are often not attended to in terms of leadership and group life. So it's a powerful learning method, but the question is it accessible enough? Is it replicable enough? Is it scalable enough to actually make a significant impact on the issues of racial justice and other issues of social justice? That's the experiment that I came back with, holding on to that experiment. It's still in progress, despite the fact that I've now directed 3 conferences and staffed a number of others since my return. It's still in progress. I still don't know. And I think that not knowing relates to, you know, some of the thoughts, my thoughts about the future of group relations.
Okay, I want to hear them. And I appreciate that reflection that you have about your journey, your hiatus, your return, your leave taking. I remember, actually, I was on staff at that 2019 conference. It just flashed on me when you said that, because I remember that being your return. And we were talking about it and excited about it a little bit on the staff. And that, you know, you sitting out there in the membership, and I felt like you were getting a little bit excited about being back too. So that's a good memory. But I wanted to, and I want to talk about the social justice experiment, to quote you, and your thoughts about it for the future and now. But I want, if you could, in terms of your director role and what that means, to take that up. You mentioned the servant leadership attitude. And I think that would be, it's interesting to me to hear about it from you and also for, you know, for our listeners. Could you say a little bit more about what that means to you?
Sure. As I said, I think it's natural early in a person's career in group relations work that they look towards the directorship as a goal. You know, one of the things I've often said over the years, I've often quoted Napoleon, who said something like, in every corporal's knapsack, there's a marshal's baton, right? And which was his way of saying, ambition is natural, which I firmly believe, ambition is natural. But I think when one is younger in the work, the directorship, again, looks so golden. It looks as if it's going to be an opportunity to have one's will enacted, right? There's lots of recognition to it. You're the focus of attention. There's lots of power, or at least those are the fantasies about the director role. When you get into it, you find that the reality is different. And fairly quickly, I think, or let me talk about these days. These days, I'm very rooted in a servant leadership model towards the directorship in terms of primary motivation. And I think it's quite necessary, because if you're going into it mostly or even significantly for ego gratification, you're going to be disappointed pretty quickly. And the work's too tough to do it just. The work of being a director is too tough to do it simply because you want your ego gratified. It has to be approached as an act of service, because that's the only thing that will get you through it. It's a lot of tough work. The director has to contain the entire enterprise, both logistically with the help of a lot of help and psychodynamically. And that's a lot to contain. It's a lot of work. And a director is, you know, as opposed to thinking that one is going to be a Mayan god, you know, you find out that you're attacked left and right. And that's simply part of the staff and the members encounter for authority. That comes with that encounter with authority. That simply comes with the territory. So the reality is quite different than those early visions of golden directorship. And in order to do it, one has to have a strong reason that is outside of oneself and outside of one's ego needs. I mean, we're human, so those things never completely go away, but the primary reason has to be outside of oneself.
That's really interesting. And really makes a lot of sense. And I really connect with you on the containment piece, which is huge. Having directed only 3 conferences myself, I don't have as much directing experience as you do, but I do remember being really taken aback by the containment part of it. At times was really exciting, exhilarating, but also quite exhausting. And it's containment over possibly a year, right? From the inception of the idea of the conference. And maybe if you have a contract for 3 years or whatever, you know, the situation is, it's a lot of containment. And then, you know, the other thing that was really interesting to me in, and I wanted to connect and see what you think about this in the role and in other leadership roles that I've taken up, for example, professionally, you know, in my profession, academia, the loneliness of the role. You know, it can be very lonely, and people who are your colleagues and allies can change in their behavior towards you and their attitudes towards you. And that was really something that was very powerful, and I hadn't given it a lot of thought, but I don't think that we talk about that enough either. But what do you think?
No, I totally agree. Both within and without the fact that relationships change, both within the conference and without. So I've heard senior practitioners, and I totally agree, saying things like, I know this conference. I know that I'm taking the risk by joining the staff of this conference that my relationships with some of you, my colleagues on staff, are going to change, and sometimes in ways for the worse, right? And that's a risk. And that's a very real risk because the work is so powerful. And yes, we're all professionals. We all work to contain it and manage it and recognize for what it is. But it often has that sort of dramatic effect. And externally, because I'm getting this from your comment too, externally, you know, even if we're not talking about colleagues on a particular staff, our external colleagues also sort of change a bit in relationship to us when we take up a directorship. And again, you know, there's ambition, there's envy, there's competition, there's all those human things. But there's also, I think, a recognition of how tough the work is, and colleagues wanting to both be available as a sounding board, a source, and at the same time wondering, do I really want to get into this morass, even though this is my friend and colleague?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's one more thing I wanted to also say that you said that I really like about how you described it, the initial impression of the leadership role. I also include that consulting roles as leadership roles as being golden.
Yes.
I really like that because I remember that was my experience of seeing, you know, at the Northwestern Conference, my first and second one in particular, of seeing the staff come in. You know how they used to do that ceremonial thing. Sunny used to do that, where the people would come. The staff comes in and they sit, and they're just so, I just experienced the staff as being so regal and silent and in control, and, you know, my fantasies, of course, but I remember thinking, oh, I want to do that. Oh yeah. I mean, that was like one of the first things I thought was like, oh my gosh, look at that. I want that. I want to do that thing right there. So you're right. You're right about the description of it being golden and being something sought after and fantasized about, and that the reality is some of that, but mostly not.
Mostly not.
So I really appreciate that.
And there was a you know, the work has evolved great, thankfully, but there was a sense in those days, at least in my early days, that, you know, the magical transition was from member to staff. And that once you were a staff member, I often used to speak critically about the fantasy of an angel staff. And that is a staff that ceased being human simply because they were staff. And I still often speak to it in terms of urging staffs to recognize that, you know, everything that's going on the member side is going on our side too. transference, regression, especially regression. Regression, transference, projections, fantasy, it's all going on our side. But in those early days, I think it was that it was actually a defense against the anxiety of the work, that the thought was that the staff role would protect you from all of that. And regrettably, some of those early staffs that I experienced, that seemed to be the cultural belief for that, for those particular conferences. And the members paid the price. The members paid the price for having a staff pretend or be lost in the fantasy that somehow they were above the anxiety, depression, everything else that was happening.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you. The members did pay the price. And to add to what you're saying, I think also, you know, and I talk about my colleagues about this a lot, it's important to be a member again after you've been on staff. You know, that also eliminates some of the sort of hierarchical dynamics around our work. When you get back, for me anyway, when I would get back into the role of being a member and the struggle that I had to really integrate my learning as having been staff, having been director, and also being a member. And what does that mean now?
Yes.
For me to be a member. That was really, really invigorating. And I want to do more of that for myself as well.
Yeah. I think being a member is key to one's work on staff. I've done probably 24 conferences as a member. And in truth, half of those conferences I've done since the first online one appeared in mid-2020. So I've done like a dozen conferences in the last 3+ years. One, because they're so convenient. The online ones have been so convenient. But two, because I really believe that the continuing to have the membership experience regularly contributes greatly to one's competence as a staff person in terms of giving one a basis of empathy for the membership experience and in a lot of other ways.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, the empathic piece as well. And, you know, before we started doing more online conferences, I was so concerned with when I would become a member and go to a conference as a member, I was so concerned with being competitive with the staff and knowing the staff, that I would do international conferences more as a member when I could afford it time-wise, financially, et cetera, because I didn't know the staff usually, maybe except for one or two people, and I didn't know the membership. And it was, that's another thing I want to say. I think we need in our work as American group relations practitioners to not only do international conferences when we get hired, as staff, but if we can, and it's not always easy to do international conferences in person, I think, you know, for a long time I've been an advocate of that as well, but now it's easier because we can do the virtual conferences, but I still advocate for the in-person as well as members. So thank you for the richness of your response around that and the interaction that we're having around. It's so interesting to talk about these things. And I want to get back to what you were saying about social justice and group relations and what the future would hold for you and what you think it might hold for others as well. Can you say a little bit more about that in terms of the future of the work?
You know, I think it seems to me that there are two paths. Probably it's more accurate to say that there are at least two paths visible to me right now for the work going forward. One is, and they're parallel paths, they're not mutually exclusive. One is, there are a great number of people, practitioners these days, who are trying to evolve the work in ways to make it less infused with white supremacy, less infused with capitalism, less infused with the patriarchy, heterosexism, and all those things that we really stand against in our fuller lives. There are folks who are trying to experiment with the structures, the processes, etc., to see whether the work can be rehabbed to make it a more fitting instrument to tackle these larger issues, which are critical to our lives. And then at the same time, another path forward is folks who are saying, you know, we're never going to be able to rehab this enough. You know, it is so infused with white supremacy and capitalism and patriarchy, etc. The whole notion of the master's tools. Can you rebuild a house with the master's tools? So those folks, you know, have been starting to think about, what do we do instead? You know, we're group relations practitioners. We know our method. But if we were to start with a blank page and bring in everything that we know, not just group relations, but other areas of knowledge and experience, could we do something different that is a better suited tool to explore issues of race and issues of other issues of social justice? Can we do something that is less the master's tools? So I think both of those, paths, you know, are paths forward.
Yeah, I think I like the Audre Lorde's master's tools reference. And I agree with you about both of those ways of looking at the work. I don't think it's a binary. I think it's both ways, because I do, you know, I kind of think of myself as a theorist, and I like the idea of a malleable theory that you can work with. And so I like the idea of holding on to what we have, but also finding new ways, as you were saying, to do both. So I want to say one more thing, but before we do that, we're going to get to the last question. I'm going to take a little break. I need a little break. Do you need a little break? Okay. All right. We'll leave everything on and come back in a minute or two. Okay.
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 All right. Two more questions. And I wanted to ask you, do you have any projects that you're working on that you might like to share and talk about?
Well, of course, you know, I have two more. You know, I was hired by the Boston Center to direct a series of three conferences. One was just a month ago. The first was completed just a month ago. And the next two will be over the next 2 years, 24 and 25. My most recent conference was focused on, at least in terms of the theme, it was focused on the issues of authority, leadership, and power that are all around us, attached to the various transitions in leadership in all of the contexts in which we exist, you know, in terms of the generations. And I'm not just talking about the chronological generations, but in talking about the philosophical generations and the methodological generations, et cetera. We're surrounded by transitions, and there are lots of things to examine there in terms of how one exercises authority, leadership, and power in the midst of all those transitions. Building on that and responding to what's going on, particularly in our country, but really in the world, in terms of polarization, you know, I'd like to focus my next conference on authority, leadership, and power in the midst of polarization. You know, that's not my title yet, but that's sort of the theme. So taking a look at, you know, the notion of civil war, not just literal civil war, but civil war, internal civil war that we all struggle with. And then going from there for the third conference with whatever seems relevant and useful at the time. So I'm very much engaged in that particular conference.
Well, you sound like you're going to be really busy and doing a lot of that containment and innovation. And this sounds exciting. We are trying to develop a resource page. And so I will check back with you once we get that done to see if you want to share some of the upcoming conference work that you're going to do and highlights of it in terms of links and brochures and things like that. But congratulations on doing that work.
Well, thank you very much. And I'd love to be part of the research page, but I also want to say in a more general sense that the majority of my group relations work these days is devoted to developing others. I'm doing a lot of mentoring, both formal mentoring and informal mentoring, a lot of support to others coming up in the work, trying to create opportunities for people to take up roles. I'm particularly interested in broadening and deepening the pool of available Latine directors, right?
Yes.
Creating opportunities for young people who are younger in the work to take up the role so that we expand that pool considerably. But that's just one instance of the work that I'm doing that comes under the heading of mentoring and developing and supporting. That's the sort of work that really excites me these days. I mean, I love the conference work, of course, but helping others to develop in this work really excites me these days.
That's really great to hear. And also, you know what it connects with? It connects with my earlier question about the future of group relations work, because that mentoring and supporting of Latine, you know, colleagues, younger people, people who are not so young, whatever the situation is, people who are just really at any chronological age, but, you know, are interested in group relations work is important. And it is about the future of the work. So I say congratulations to you for your efforts on that as well. That's really great to hear. And I have, I have one more question for you, but I am curious about one more thing. Before the final question, I want to go back to what you said about the future of the work being done, utilizing the, let's say, the old ways of doing it, and then trying to figure out new ways of doing the work. When you are directing, where do you think you are on that continuum? How are you, you know, working with both of those modalities, or are you? I think you are, but what do you say?
I think I am too, but it's hard to describe. I think it's still crystallizing for me. Let me say this. I believe, you know, I'm a classically trained practitioner, right? I mean, I've tried really hard to shed as much of the nonsensical authoritarianism in the work, right, as I can, as I've developed as a practitioner. But, you know, I was very thoroughly trained by lots of people in terms of the core components of the work and what's really important in holding roles, for example. So I'm a classically trained practitioner who's trying to do the work in innovative ways around innovative themes. Sometimes I scare my staffs. I think that was an experience that my most recent staff had. You know, I was intentional about creating opportunities for people who are younger in the work. And many of these folks also, many of their mentors and teachers are practitioners who were classically trained. And I think in my latest conference, as I veered from the classic tradition, for example, in the way that we encountered the membership in the what I was calling the SIA, the intergroup, the institutional event. I called it the systems in action event. But in the way we encountered the membership, the humanity we were willing to show in the discussion session for that event freaked my younger staff out a little bit because they weren't clear what I was doing, right? And I realized that was a learning for me after the fact. I just assumed that they were younger, more progressive, and they would be more fluid and go for me. But yet I was veering from what they had experienced at that point. So, you know, very much experimenting with holding on to the core of the work, being aware of the nonsense that has become attached to the core, and trying to shed that, and yet trying to use the work in different sorts of ways that I think all with the guiding light of what's actually going to be helpful to the members, what's helpful to their learning. We are not there to lord it over them. We are there to support their learning and what's actually going to be helpful, whether it goes contrary to the ways that we've been trained or not. What are we willing to experiment with?
Yeah, that's really, it makes me think back to what you were saying. That's really interesting that you're expressing it in that way in answer to my question, because it goes back for me to the servant, being of service, right? The servant leadership attitude, the servant leadership role or model. And also, you know, in asking that question and listening to your response, I'm aware of the fluidity that we, you know, that we need to have in doing the work. We can't, and the spontaneity, because we do have to be, we have to be there for the members. We have to do the work in a way that the members will benefit, hopefully benefit from and learn from. And so, and not be harmed by. So that's really helpful, what you said, for me to think about as well. So now we are at the last question, which is, I'm going to ask you, if you have a descriptive metaphor that you would choose to describe your relationship to group relations work.
I do. I think the work and I are critical lovers, right? I am, there's no doubt that we are in a lover sort of relationship, have been since practically the beginning, even though, although we took a break from each other of 13 years. But the lover piece is no doubt of my attachment to the work, my continued attraction to the work, my continued willingness to explore what's there, what's in the work, what's in the relationship, et cetera. And having come back to the work, even after a long hiatus. So the lover piece is clear. The critical piece, by that I'm trying to express the fact that, you know, I'm in it with my eyes open. And again, the primary experiment for me is this useful enough to the things that we want to do in the bigger world? Is this useful enough to justify our expenditures of time and energy, right? And if it is, great. And if it isn't, you know, we kiss each other on the cheek and we wish each other well, right? And we go off. So that metaphor of one being of critical lovers is one that fits for me.
I like it. It's really descriptive and really thought-provoking, critical lovers. Thank you for that. It's very, very interesting. And, you know, it also makes me think about what you'd said about your 13-year hiatus, even though you weren't actively, you know, a member of ACRI, for example, you weren't actively pursuing the work and doing the work, you were still being invited to be on staff. So the group work was still in your life. And I'm guessing that you were still using it as your lens for almost anything that you might do. So it was a part of you in the way that, you know, a lover or someone that you do love or something that you do love, have love for, continues to be a part of you, even though you are not actively in relationship.
Absolutely. Great. Great.
That entity.
Great. That's a great extension.
Good. I'm glad you think so. And thank you for that metaphor. It's a great one. I really like it. So we are at an end of our interview, and I just want to thank you, Mac Winlock, so, so very much for taking time to do this interview with me for the GRI podcast. Thank you for being a guest. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you, Ellen, my friend, for the invitation and a wonderful opportunity. This time has just gone by in a flash. I could stay here with you and talk for another couple of days, I think, but we don't have that time. But thank you very much for the opportunity. I've really enjoyed it.
I'm glad you had a great experience, and thank you so much for saying that. Beyond the Boundaries, a group relations podcast, was produced and edited by me, Dr. Ellen Short, and also by Emmanuel Manny Molin, and is a Group Relations International production. Beyond the Boundaries can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Group Relations International's website, which is www.grouprelations.org. Thank you for listening.